Well, ladies and gentlemen, here we are at the last chapter of Esther, chapter 10. Our context is this, of course. In chapter 9, the Jews have wiped out all of their enemies, 75,000 of them, in the provinces of Persia, and 800 of their enemies in the capital city of Susa. This last chapter is only 3 verses long, so this will be a quick audio this time. We will call it The Greatness of Mordecai. Now, I apologize for my voice. I'm in the third day of COVID-19. Fortunately, this is 2022. I managed to go 3 years without catching that damnable virus. And it's much milder. I've had sinusitis that's 10 times worse. So I'm not going to stop. I hope you'll put up with my raspy voice in order to listen to this exposition of chapter 10 of Esther. We start now in Esther 10, verses 1 through 3. King Ahasuerus, remember that's Xerxes, imposed a tax throughout the land, even to the farthest shores. All of his powerful and magnificent accomplishments and the detailed account of Mordecai's great rank to which the king had honored him, have they not been written in the historical records of the kings of Media and Persia? All of those words were capitalized in the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. Mordecai the Jew was second only to King Ahasuerus, famous among the Jews, and highly popular with many of his relatives. He continued to seek good for his people and to speak for the welfare of all his descendants. Now, a little introductory note here. The Septuagint translation adds 10 verses to this chapter, plus 6 more chapters. I don't know where they got that. A translation of these extra chapters and verses you can find in English versions of the Apocrypha. We're not going to worry about that. Now, verse 1, Xerxes imposes a tax even to the farthest shores. Other translations of farthest shores. The NIV has distant shores. The NASB has coastlands. Remember, the Persian Empire extended all the way through Asia Minor, and Asia Minor is the northern shore of the Mediterranean Sea. John Gill says that, and I would add also the Persian Empire extended to the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf, so there were some shores down there. KJV has Isles of the Sea, coastlands and isles translated either way. But if you translate it as Isles of the Sea or Islands of the Sea, that could refer to the Greek islands and the Aegean Sea, as Adam Clark says. Doesn't really matter. The point is that there's attacks all through the empire, the large empire. Now, the first question that pops into my head is, who cares? Why would this account that's obviously aimed at magnifying Mordecai, why would it mention that Xerxes had put a tax on his subjects that extended the tax, which tax extended to the farthest reaches of the empire? Doesn't sound to me like it has any relevance. Well, here's a couple of reasons or options to show that there is relevance. It could be showing that Ahasuerus had taxing authority over the whole world, and Mordecai is second only to Ahasuerus in power, and this shows that Mordecai was a very great man. This is the Cambridge Commentary's suggestion. I think they're right. Some people have suggested that maybe it's talking about Xerxes taxing those who were trying to kill the Jews, and that's reasonable too, I suppose. But it doesn't say that, and it seems to me, again, this is an argument from silence, or the argument that Ahasuerus was taxing the Jews' enemies is an argument from silence, and I don't think it's very strong here. So I think the point is to show how much power King Xerxes had, because in verse 2 it says, all of his powerful Xerxes, powerful and magnificent accomplishments, were mentioned in the Persian Chronicles, their historical records of the kings of Media and Persia. And so Ahasuerus' great deeds were recorded, and the detailed account of Mordecai's great rank, to which this great Xerxes had honored him, that's also in the historical records. In other words, Mordecai was such a big shot that he ended up in the history books. He is listed along with the king who had the ability to tax the whole known world. Now, when did this tax occur? Here's a couple of options. One is after the Greek Wars, when the Persian treasury would be drained. This is Ellicott's view. Remember the great battle with the Greeks that Xerxes fought? The first was Salamis in 480. Xerxes lost that one. And the Plataea, his generals, lost that one. That was in 479. And then Ellicott also points out the Persians fought the Greeks for 10 years afterwards along the coast of Asia Minor, all those Greek cities along the western coast. These are famous battles in ancient history. Well, all of that costs money. Now, the events of Esther took place in the 12th year of Ahasuerus, as we know from previous verses. So, Xerxes ruled from 486 to 465. The 12th year of that reign would be 474. That would be 5 years after Plataea, and plus he's still battling the Greeks in Western Asia Minor. That takes money. He needs money. So that makes sense. Some people have suggested that this tax was a renewal of the tribute which he had remitted upon the marriage of Esther. Esther 2:18, then the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and his servants. He also made a holiday for the prince's provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty. That holiday, of course, would have to be a tax holiday. You have to read into that a little bit. I don't know. I don't think that's correct, because obviously kings often gave tax holidays for when they acceded to the throne, things like that. But the taxes are usually reimposed. It's no big deal, and why would it be mentioned here in verse 1? In my opinion, the reason it's mentioned here is just to show his power, Xerxes' power, and putting a tax back on the people just because the marriage banquet is over does not really seem to me to show the great power of Xerxes. A third option as to what this tax was for is because Xerxes thought that he would tax the enemies of the Jews. I mentioned this earlier, and that's the reason. Well, I think that Xerxes' motive in passing the tax was to get money because of those wars with the Greeks that were bedeviling his administration. Now, in verse 2, the acts of Xerxes and Mordecai were recorded in the historical record of the kings of Media and Persia. Now, NIV Study Bible, writing in 1994, says that archaeologists have not yet discovered that chronicle. However, there is archaeological evidence of an official whose name was very close to Mordecai. His name was Mardukiah. Mordecai, Mardukiah, in English it sounds pretty close. Now, verse 3 says that Mordecai the Jew was second only to King Ahasuerus. What did that mean as far as what power did Mordecai have? Well, it meant he could frequently act on his own, as the NIV Study Bible says. He was the king's most trusted advisor for the occasions when the king had to make a decision. His position gave Mordecai an unlimited opportunity to shape the policies of the empire. That high position of power, being second to the king, guaranteed the safety of the Jews in a foreign land, just like Joseph when Joseph was in Egypt. Genesis 41:43, the Pharaoh had Joseph ride in his second chariot, and they proclaimed before him, "Bow the knee," and the Pharaoh set Joseph over all the land of Egypt, like Daniel in Babylonia, Daniel 6, verses 2 through 3, and over them. The them referring to the three commissioners that were hired by the Persian government, which Daniel was working for now because Persia has conquered Babylonia. This is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So over these commissioners, these satraps might be accountable to them that the king might not suffer loss. Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit. And the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. So those are some great examples of how God brings favor to protect his people in the midst of overwhelming paganism, racial and religious prejudice, etc., etc., etc. And here's our last example, Mordecai. Now, let's finish up this short audio with a comment from Jamieson Fawcett and Brown. I said this chapter should be called The Greatness of Mordecai, but what's the theme that's probably even more prominent than that? It's the providence of God in putting Mordecai where he was in order to protect the Jews. Here's what Jamieson Fawcett and Brown say. The providence of God is plainly traceable in all the steps that led to Mordecai's unexpected advancement. This providential interposition is all the more remarkable that, as in the analogous case of Joseph, it was displayed in making the ordinary and natural course of things lead to the most marvelous results. To use the pious words of an eminent prelate, though in the whole of this episode there was no extraordinary manifestation of God's power, no particular cause or agent that was in its working advanced above the ordinary pitch of nature, yet the contrivance and suiting these ordinary agents appointed by God is in itself more admirable than if the same end had not been effected by means that were truly miraculous. And, of course, what that shows is that God rules the affairs of this world even when he's not doing miracles. It was only late in my life that I really thought about the distinction between God's providence and God's miraculous workings. When God does a miracle, in fact, the line between miracle and providence is sort of blurry, because there are some things that we actually, in our common language, call miraculous, which are not really miraculous. Let's, for example, I like this story. There was in the church I used to go to, there was an engineer, the most unromantic person I've ever met in my life. He was a nerd. He was the nerd of nerds. He was a nerd. And his wife, who was also, of course, going to church with us, and I knew her very well, she was Maid Marian, the librarian. I mean, she was sweet as she could be, but she was not romantic. She was the perfect good housewife, living in some small, it was like if you go to some small Midwestern town, and there's the woman working in the kitchen and taking care of her kids and just smiling all the time. Oh, my gosh. Romance. It's the furthest thing from her mind. All right. So one day we were talking about how they got married, and he said, well, I was going to some kind of engineering conference, and I'm sitting on an airplane. And all of a sudden, this young lady sits next to me. It was a miracle. And we got married. We fell in love and got married. Well, it's very romantic. And so you say, well, that's a miracle. No, it's not actually a miracle. It was providence, because nothing really supernatural happened. They bought their airplane tickets. They got on the plane. They struck up a conversation. There was nothing out of the ordinary. But you could see how God used the ordinary workings of nature in order to produce a wonderful result. It doesn't matter whether it's providence, whether it's natural, whether it's supernatural. Even in the natural things, God arranges the natural things to bring about his purposes. And this story of Esther really helps to show that. So, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished the book of Esther, and we are now prepared to journey on as we travel through the Old Testament to the book of Job, that sobering book that everybody knows about because everybody suffers like Job did. We'll start on that in our next audio. Stay tuned for that, and hope you enjoyed this audio.